of E-12 budget, and joined with Senator Torres Ray, the chair of Ed Policy. We are so delighted to have as our focus today several of the cream of the crop teachers of the year in Minnesota. And it's a chance, we're not in session, just to reflect, to listen, actively listen, and engage in some conversation about key issues that we have a great deal of passion about. A lot of legislation, a lot of talk. Any ideas that we have, though, it's going to screen through the classroom, and we have the best right here. And I had the privilege of going to a conference this summer sponsored by the Education Commission of States. I'm our representative now with a couple of others. I replaced Senator Jen Olson, who did a very good job there. And they invited the Education Commission, the Teachers of the Year, and Jackie Rail, representing Minnesota, and you'll hear from her soon, was there. And we said, you get together, you share a lot of ideas, and why not with the committee? And so is a little background as to why we scheduled this, and I thought during the interim would be a good time. So it's that background, and we're going to get into testimony, more presentation, 5 minutes or so from each person, and you have bios. They may touch a little bit about themselves in their presentation, but bios are at your place if you'd like to review that as well. And I can assure you that at least one of the teachers knows you very, very well and has taught your kids, and so that was really cool to learn about that. We'll have us go around and introduce ourselves for our guests, panelists today, and testifiers. First of all, I'd like to Senator Torres Ray, have any opening remarks, and then we'll go around and introduce ourselves for the testifiers. Senator Torres Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you so much for being here. I am just delighted to see you and looking forward to hear from you as to how we can partner. I've been invited to attend, just like the chair, so many meetings, and people are so excited about the future and some of the directions we are taking in terms of major investments and reforms in education. So I'm looking forward to hear your presentation, your ideas, and I know Katie and I were yesterday together in an early childhood pre-K, third grade conference with Chuck as well and other members who were here, and that was an exciting opportunity to see so many teachers as well. There was a conference for ELL teachers this weekend. There were about 850 teachers there, so I think the energy is just very exciting, and I just look forward to the next session and a few years here working on implementing those ideas. I represent Minneapolis, by the way. That's District 63.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Torres Ray. And Senator Kent, we're going to just go around the table. If each of you could identify yourself, your district, and any short comments related to that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Susan Kent. I am the state senator from District 53, which is Woodbury, and parts of Maplewood, Oakdale, and Landfall. And I have three really great school districts out there, so South Washington County, Stillwater, and 622, North St. Paul, Maplewood, Oakdale.
I'm Alice Johnson from the District 37, which includes Blaine, Spring Lake Park, and Coon Rapids, parts of almost all of Blaine, but parts of Coon Rapids and Spring Lake Park. So I represent the largest school district in the state, which is always up for grabs, the Anoka-Hennepin School District, Spring Lake Park School District, and a small portion of Centennial School District. And I've all of my adult life, I have felt that education and what happens to the kids in school is the most important thing in all of their lives. And now I'm becoming aware that it really is at home also, with birth through graduation, wherever, to adult life. But it's wonderful, and I'm very proud of the teachers that we have in Minnesota, and you especially, the Teachers of the Year. So thank you for being here.
Good morning. My name is Melissa Franzen, and I represent District 49, which is Edina, West Bloomington, portions of Eden Prairie, Minnetonka. And I'm excited to see some of our constituents here at the table testifying. Jackie Rayo, very proud of our Teacher of the Year in 2012, but very proud of all of you and the work that you do. I have lots of friends that are in the teaching profession and family members, and I really do commend you for the hard work that you do every day for our community. And I'm excited to hear your testimony today. Thank you.
I'm Melissa Halverson-Wickland, and I represent District 50, which is the remainder of Bloomington and then part of Richfield. And I'm really excited to hear from you today. I was on the school board in Bloomington before I came to the Senate, and really feel very strongly about how can we better support our teachers and value our teachers. And it's you played such an important role in our society. So really glad to hear your testimony today.
My name is Jay Wilms. I'm the legislative fiscal analyst for the E-12 committee.
Bjorn Arneson, research analyst for the education committees.
Anne Marie Butler, I'm the counsel to the education committees.
Senator Karen Housley, I represent Senate District 39, which are school districts Stillwater, Forest Lake, and parts of Montemedi. I want to thank all of you for the hard work you do. Both my parents were public school teachers, so I know that your summers off aren't always summers off, but thank you very much, and especially Mr. O, Derek Olson. He is the school teacher that my children went to, Afton Lakeland Elementary, and there is not a child that goes to Afton Lakeland that doesn't want Mr. O for a teacher. I don't know if Mr. O wanted the Housley children, but you got stuck with them, and they're turning out okay, so thank you.
Senator Gary Dames from Senate District 16, which is part of Brown County, Renville County, Redwood County, Lyon County, Yellow Meadows, and Lacaparra counties in southwest Minnesota. And I would like to thank you folks for all your hard work and appreciate your commitment in your ongoing endeavors. Thank you very much.
Hi, I'm Senator Dan Hall. I'm from the Burnsville, Savage, Lakeville area. And I, too, appreciate teachers and what they have done, continue to do, and we hope to hear some new things from you today. So thank you.
Good morning. I'm Eric Pratt. I represent Northern Scott County, so Prior Lake, Shakopee, and Jordan. I spent 12 years on the school board, where I was both chairman and treasurer for most of my time. And like my colleagues, I'm interested in starting a dialogue.
Good morning. My name is Greg Clausen, and I serve the communities of Apple Valley, Rosemont, Northeast Lakeville, and the town of Coates. I'm also a former high school principal for 15 years with the Rosemont, Apple Valley, Eagan Public Schools. And during that time, I had the privilege of writing three letters of recommendation for teachers that were nominated for Teachers of the Year. And you're an important part of the state of Minnesota, and I greatly appreciate the work you do, and congratulations. Thank you.
Dave Thompson. I live in Lakeville and have the part of Lakeville that Greg and Dan don't cover, and also Farmington and a large part of Southern Dakota County right down to the Northfield border. As we speak, both my wife and my sister are in classrooms teaching and have great respect for what you do and the influence that you have on our young people, so thanks for being here.
Thank you, members. And now we're going to go to the stars of the show, and we're going to go left to right, and in order of the agenda, Leanne Stevens from St. Louis Park Senior High. And as I mentioned earlier, bios are a part of the materials, but certainly you can include some highlights as you get into your 5 or so minute initial presentation. Then we'll hear from each of you, and then we'll open it up for discussion. So welcome, and just as a reminder, we appreciate everyone being at the table. You'll need to get close to the mic. We are being recorded and televised. Welcome.
All right. So thank you so much for this opportunity, and I love that you said 5 minutes or so. Thank you. I like the so part. And we will introduce ourselves individually. I am Leanne Stevens, and I work at St. Louis Park High School. I work specifically with Latino and African-American students who take advanced placement classes, honors, and IB. And so I'm their advocate, and that is quite a role, and I am so honored to be able to serve them in that manner. So And I thank you because you have a chance to make a tremendous impact upon the lives of our students and teachers in the state. And so, as we know, the achievement gap is well and alive in our great state of Minnesota. We're aware of the NAEP scores that came out last week touting the success of our fourth and eighth grade students. And although that our fourth grade Black students have improved, we know that the gap still exists. And if you read a column by a well-known Minnesota radio talk show host, you would be under the assumption that the achievement gap is inevitable. And in essence, we should just accept it. Well, that belief is synonymous with saying that we're all going to die, so let's try not to find a cure for cancer, ALS, or any other disease. Now, that statement will be viewed as ludicrous, but somehow we have people nodding their heads in agreement with this statement. But I have the honor to work with Black and Brown students on a daily basis who are mythbusters. And why do I call them mythbusters? Well, in my world and the world of my students, the labels that are normally attached to them, they view as false. So labels such as they lack motivation or respect, or they lack respect for authority, they lack intellectual prowess, or the drive to excel. So for every negative story, I have a counter story. For example, I have Maison, Opema, and they told me I could use their names, so they're cool with it. Mohammed, Aman, Ayan, Nastia, and Kayla, who will meet me on a Sunday afternoon in St. Louis Park at a Caribou to study advanced placement psychology, and some of them will take the bus from Minneapolis to meet me. I have Black students who are absent from school who will call in and be placed on speakerphone so that they can be part of a study session. I have Black students who will meet me an hour or so before school to study. I have Black students who are begging for quality teaching, begging to be challenged. See, these are my myth busters. They crowd into my room every day, and they sit on the shelves that outline my windows, or they're on the floor, or they sit at the table in the middle of my room. Their intellectual capital really permeates that room, and it's palpable. Khadijah, I have an example. Khadijah, she's a student who exudes strength of character. Khadijah has definitely taken the road less traveled. So although she's encountered some rocky situations on her journey, she hasn't been deterred. Last year, Khadijah joined our school's newspaper, which is a very excellent newspaper. It's been nationally given awards. She was the only Black student on staff. Not only did her skin color cause her to stand out, but her Muslim attire caused her to stand out as well. Khadijah's outgoing. She's very caring. And so, of course, she wanted to bond with the other newspaper staff members. This task proved to be very challenging for her. So after many attempts to be heard and accepted, she began to feel rejected and isolated. She and I had very many had a lot of conversations about this experience. And at one point, like, she wanted to quit. But I convinced her that she needed to persevere and not give up because she was paving the way for other Black students to be a part of this traditionally exclusive group. Not only was she paving the way for them, but for other students who might not fit the mold. She's now one of the editors of the paper, and her perseverance and drive paid off. She's my mythbuster. Another mythbuster is Nazro. In Nazro's IB history class, she had to do a presentation with another partner. The partner didn't show up. And so she could have used that as an excuse not to continue, but she said, I was in her head telling her that she could do this. And so she did her presentation by herself, and she did a stellar job and actually received an A on her presentation. You see, my mythbusters know that what other people might seem as exceptional for them, it's what I expect from them. They know that life can be hard, but they're not allowed to use that as an excuse for them not to succeed. They inspire me not only to be a better teacher, but to be a better person. Somehow, though, we've placed the responsibility of the gap solely on the students and external factors outside our control. And as if you know teachers, you know we want to control everything. I would love to control what goes on in the home, but I can't. But I can control what I do on a daily basis with the students. And am I giving them my absolute best? And when we blame the students, then we accept the situation as unchangeable. Thus, we absolve ourselves of any responsibility. Can the gap be eliminated? Absolutely. Is it hard work? Absolutely. In the words of Eric Mahmoud, is it rocket science? No, it's harder because we have sent a rocket into space. Are there schools closing the gap? We have them in our own Black backyard. But I think the question remains, do we believe that black and brown students are capable of achieving at high levels? Do we believe that they are worth educating? And do we believe that we will be a better state as a result of eliminating the gap? And I say yes, yes, and yes. 13 years ago, Bill Clinton said the following: we know that the achievement levels can be raised. The question is whether we have the will to do what we know works. If we're going to set high expectations of students, we must have high expectations of ourselves to do what it takes to make sure all of our students can make the grade. The racial disparity in achievement we have in Minnesota requires action from each one of us. We all must hold responsibility and accountability for doing what we can do to change this. Martin Luther King Jr. said, whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly. I can never be what I ought to be until you are what you ought to be. I say the racial disparity in achievement affects black and brown students directly, but it affects all students indirectly. And we can never be what we ought to be as a state until they are what they ought to be. Thank you for your attention.
Wow. Thank you. Two senators joined us. I'd like them to each introduce themselves and just briefly their district. Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Chair Wieger. I'm Senator Carla Nelson. I live in Rochester, former Rochester teacher, Title I teacher, special education teacher, and a reading teacher at the middle school. And I represent Rochester School District, Stuartville, Dover, Eota, and Chatfield school districts. And I'm the minority lead on the Education Policy Committee.
Hi, I'm Senator Vicki Jensen. I'm from Senate District 24, which includes the county of Steele, Dodge, Rice, and Waseca.
Thank you. Our next testifier, Katie Smith from Winona.
I am. Thank you very much for having me. I'm honored to be here. My name is Katie Smith, and I teach at Early Childhood Family Education, known as ECFE in this great state of Minnesota. I teach parent education. Early childhood family education is an arm of community education full of all kinds of programs that are helping Minnesota bridge the gap. In adult basic education, in school readiness, in supporting ELL families, and in all kinds of ways, community education has your back. The program nearest and dearest to my heart, of course, is one that transformed my own parenting, and from what I hear from thousands of Minnesotans all across the state is the same thing. Where would I be without ECFE? The achievement gap begins at birth. I'm going to say that again in case it's the first time you heard it, but the achievement gap begins at birth. Lots of times people can identify it because kids start to talk at age 2. But I will tell you, I do a fair amount of home visiting, and I know when I'm walking into a home where there's very little chance of hope there, there's all kinds of poverty, and the one I feel like I work at the forefront of is a poverty of hope with parents with brand new babies. And so I bring not only curriculum and a sling and books, but a chance for education for parents to do better so they can do better by their kids. As a parent educator, I am insanely interested, really insanely interested, in building the capacities of those Minnesotans who care for small children. I would like to claim that, building capacities in the adults who care for children, as my own, but I have to give that credit to Jack Shonkoff from Harvard. Although the idea is intriguing to me, and it's caught me, and it's captured me, and it's helped me define my work and explain it to people who don't work inside of a school system. Those Minnesotans who are caring for our youngest learners from 0 to 5 are not only parents, but grandparents, friends, families, and neighbors, but they're also providers, in-home providers, childcare providers, and center providers. They're Head Start professionals, they're paraprofessionals, and there are all of our communities at large. Minnesota tells small children how much we value them by the people we put in their path. I do the achievement gap work. I'm grateful for the state's investment in early childhood. It was an amazing session, and I don't know if you heard the rumbling come back to you, but those of us who work in early childhood, we're delighted to hear you all say early childhood, not only with your voices, but with your investment. It means so much to us. All-day kindergarten will be, and you've started to see, right, that is transformative. I sometimes think of those scores and think, we've had an all-day kindergarten for a while now. You're going to start to see the investment pay off. Preschool scholarships, again, will be transformative. And I would be so upset with myself if I didn't tell you this, that those preschool scholarships will be very important for kids to take them out of homes of poverty and to put them in a safe, great learning place. But you compound your investment when you include parent education with it. And Minnesota is the only state that has a core of parent educators, licensed teachers, who are ready to take the charge. Minnesota, do I have to steal more of your water? I'm sorry. Minnesota is ready. I promise you, it is ready for strength-based parent educations with those scholarships. There is a market like there never has been before. All you need to do is search the web for blogs, parenting blogs, or walk through Barnes & Noble's to see how enormous the parenting section has been. Becoming a good parent is something that every Minnesotan wants to be, irregardless of their starting line. And we have to accept, as I sit here with colleagues who work in a K-12 system, that there is a skill set that happens at home that matches up with schools that help children achieve. It is a teachable skill set, and it's a skill set that parents are more than ready to learn. For the majority of Minnesotans, when they know better, they do better. And so let's take some time to let them know what schools are expecting of them in terms of a skill set. There's a large percentage of Minnesota kids that are in home and center care. I would love to build the capacity there. Minnesota parent educators are ready and able to do that kind of work. Kindergarten looks different than it did just one generation ago. That's an important thing for all of us to know. And so even a generation ago, one parent generation ago, doesn't know exactly what they're preparing kids for. It looks more rigorous, much more rigorous than it did when they were there. They deserve to know that. When parents know better, they do better. I'm also interested in, see, people just start taking care of me. I like that a lot. I'm also interested in building the capacity of the workforce who cares for those kids on scholarships. It will be a force. Since I began teaching, I have had the privilege to work under the same master contract as Scott Halverson, who teaches math at 10th grade at Winona Senior High School, because the work I do in my district is valued by my district as a licensed teacher. That's not true for early childhood professionals all across our state. It is not consistent for ECFE or early childhood professionals. In my first home visit with parents, I hold their brand new newborn, and I can't share their names because they can't give me permission. And I read to them. And in my head, honestly, I think about that child's graduation day. And I look around and see where they are and who's caring for them, and I do my very best to make that path smoother for them. In the short term, parent educators all across this state are ready to bridge families from early childhood family ed to our goal as a state to having every child read well by third grade. What you need there is a little parent education so parents understand what they're preparing their kids for. And no one's more excited about doing that work than I am. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Smith. Our next testifier is Derek Olson from Stillwater.
Welcome. Thank you, Senator. My name is Derek Olson. I have been teaching in elementary schools for the past 23 years, the first 10 in St. Louis Park, where Leanne is, and then for the past 13 in Stillwater, primarily in sixth grade. I am actually this semester, for the very first time in those 23 years, on an educational leave for one semester. I am completing my doctoral degree, and I'm working on my dissertation on teacher evaluation, which will be my topic today. And my working title is Award-Winning Teachers. You see some right here. Award-Winning Teachers, Perspectives on the Characteristics of Teacher Quality and the Components of Effective Teacher Evaluation. So with that, I would like to talk about teacher evaluation and how indeed it is an integral part of closing our achievement gap. As Leanne said, we clearly have an achievement gap that is for the most part indisputable. And the current research is very, very clear that as far as schooling factors, teacher quality is the single biggest thing that factor that impacts student achievement. And it's therefore no surprise that across the country, there is a heightened scrutiny looking at teacher quality, and that has resulted in, again, across the country, new looks at teacher evaluation, including here in the state. As I'm sure you're all aware and you probably voted on, there's the new statute that must be that teacher evaluation programs with a much higher level of rigor need to be enacted in all districts across the state by 2014-2015, and that's statute 122A.40, I believe. Anyway, the state has been working, just a little more background information, the state has created a default model that districts can use. Again, this may be something you're all very familiar with. That model has three components: a teacher practice component, which is the traditional teacher observation by a trained administrator, but new to that is peer observation, where I might be observing Leanne and she might be observing me. So that's very, very new for most districts. A second component is student engagement. In the default model, that will be conducted through student surveys of their teachers. Again, that's something that will be very, very new for teachers across the state. And the third is the student learning and achievement leg, and that's where the controversial student test data results come in as far as evaluating teachers. Stillwater has chosen to do what is an option that's available in the state, which is to come up with a plan on our own that meets the statute that is agreed upon by the union and the administration. And I've been part of that committee, and we have met over 50 times for the last 2 years and currently have a plan being piloted, and it has been a fabulous collaborative experience between our administrators and our unions, but a very time-consuming, very intellectually draining and challenging one to now implement in pilot form. With that background, I'd like to make three points about teacher evaluation. First of all, there's a myth out there that teachers don't want to be evaluated. And the union has actually done some polling, and teachers across the state of Minnesota are not afraid of teacher evaluation. They hope that it is valid and based on effective research, and that it focuses on teacher growth, student learning, inducting new teachers effectively into the profession, and also on peer review. The second point I'd like to make is, what is the point of teacher evaluation? It's a decision that needs to be made, because teacher evaluation systems exist on a continuum from grading and ranking teachers to developing teachers. You can collect the data, but then what are you going to do with it? Obviously, a part of the what happens needs to be to identify when we have teachers that are really struggling. But far more importantly, with all the data being collected, with all the resources that you may allocate, that districts are allocating, it would be a waste if we didn't really focus on using these teacher evaluation and development plans to develop teachers, to ensure that not just we are weeding out a few teachers that aren't doing a good job, but that we take our new teachers and help them become accomplished teachers. And we take our accomplished teachers and help them become experienced and highly effective teachers. And we take those teachers that are already highly effective, because we can all improve, and we may help them become master teachers and perhaps coaches that are helping those teachers that are in an earlier place on that path continuum of professional education. The developers of the four major models being used around the country, Danielson, Marzano, McCrell, and Strong, all strongly believe that their tools are being misused if they're used just to evaluate. In fact, most of them are very concerned when their tools are in any way tied to someone's actual salary. But what they want those tools to be used is to promote discussion, to help teachers identify where they individually can improve so they can become a better quality. We can shift the entire teacher quality of our state towards a higher level, thereby increasing student achievement. The research is clear that when teacher quality goes up, student achievement goes up. My third point I'd like to make, I'd be remiss in not making it since some of you are on the Finance Committee, and that is, currently this new statute, to my understanding, is an unfunded mandate. And I can tell you from my experience being on the committee in Stillwater, it takes an inordinate amount of resources to attempt to implement something as rigorous and new and challenging as an effective teacher evaluation and development plan. And it can be done on a shoestring, perhaps, but it can't be done well that way. And if we want to maximize what we can do with this statute. It's going to take some, in my opinion, some designated funding to provide the time, even just to have teachers be able to have time to discuss what other teachers are having to say when they come into their room, and the resources, the training that is needed for administrators to effectively go in and observe a teacher is very, very high. It takes a lot of training before their results of those evaluations can be reliable and valid in regards to being linked to achievement. So in summary, teachers welcome being evaluated. A plan will be most effective if it is focused on development, not just on grading and ranking teachers. And thirdly, to be done effectively, it really needs to be funded effectively. But if it's done properly, a teacher evaluation and development plan can be part of a statewide effort to raise teacher quality, raise student achievement, and close the achievement gap. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. O, as you are referred to.
Excuse me, I wanted to say one more thing.
Okay.
Senator Housley also is a fantastic room mother, and she does a killer bulletin board and throws a great sixth grade Halloween party.
Okay. Wonderful. And also, I'd like to introduce Senator Carlson. And Senator Carlson, if you'd just like to state your district and for members here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Jim Carlson from District 51, which is the cities of Eagan and Burnsville, and Districts 191, 196, and 197.
Continuing, and again, members will have three more presentations, and then we'll open it up for questions and comments. Next testifier is Jackie Rail from the Edina School District. Welcome.
Thank you all for being here today. I know you're not in session, so I really appreciate getting my 5 minutes to tell you about the Common Core standards. I teach 10th and 12th grade English at Edina High School, and in my 15 years there have been a lot of reforms. And the Common Core standards, I think, are the best way that we can close the achievement gap, actually nationally. They are adopted in 45 states, and it does tell teachers around the country what are some common benchmarks that a sophomore would know in an English classroom, or what are some common benchmarks a senior would know. And the Common Core State Standards actually say all students, regardless of their race or their economic background, will have these benchmarks to graduate. And because of that, it has pushed teachers to really reform their classroom and their practices, and in a positive way. And I know that Minnesota only has the reading standards adopted and not the math standards, but because states in the United States are kind of repealing Common Core now, I want to kind of urge you to keep the course and to let the reform have a chance to kind of work. And so for that, I want to tell you about my classroom kind of before Common Core and now what it looks like with the Common Core state standards in place. Before the Common Core, we really focused on literature. And we would read a book, and students would hunt and peck for metaphors and talk about the book. And really, their eyes would glaze over, and they would be kind of not engaged with the curriculum. The Common Core has said it really needs to be relevant, real life, and it's emphasized nonfiction. So detractors say the death of literature is going to happen in the English classrooms in Minnesota with this Common Core. And that's not true, because we still will read books and nonfiction and fiction throughout the year. So what a specific unit looks like in my room. Before the Common Core, we would read Chinua Achebe's Things Fall Apart. It's a story of Nigeria and colonization. And we would basically just read that text without connecting it to their lives, connecting it to their place, connecting it to big ideas. Now, after Common Core, the unit's completely revised. And we actually compare and contrast, which is a higher order thinking skill for students. We compare and contrast Nigerian colonization with the colonization of Minnesota. Minnesota also, in our Common Core standards, has in that a supplement that the other states don't have, which is that American Indian issues will be discussed in Minnesota, and specifically Minnesota American Indian issues. And last year, it was the 150th anniversary of the Dakota War, and you could survey the students at Edina High School, and maybe 5% even knew about the war, mm-hmm. or even knew about the Dakota tribe, even though the war was kind of fought right on the land our high school is built on. So because of that, now we do a compare-contrast unit where we read Minnesota Makoche selections by Gwen Westerman, talking about the Dakota land, talking about Minnesota, giving the students more place, and compare that to what are some of the similar ideas in Nigeria. And through that, we can also expand to Australia with Rabbit Proof Fence. And so we bring in documentaries too, like a TED Talk about the danger of a single story and a documentary called Dakota 38 about the largest mass hanging in Minnesota history. And the students are more engaged because it is Minnesota, and it's part of their where they are in their place. And we talk the nonfiction pieces about Minnesota history actually help that novel that has been in our curriculum for 15 years. So the death of literature is not happening because of the Common Core. There are some problems with the Common Core in terms of how are we going to assess students, because we are actually asking them to think critically with multiple perspectives, and we need to have an exam that can measure if the students are reading and thinking critically. And that is one of the things that we would need to work on as a state. So I would just say that I would really like you to hold the course on the Common Core as seven states are trying to repeal it. We have only been in our second year with this standard, and to keep reforming and changing the way that education is delivered is going to have a greater impact if we don't stick with it. So thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Rail. Our next testifier is Mike Smart from the Robbinsdale Armstrong High School.
Actually, and that may be a little out of date, but I can clarify as I go through. Okay. I'm the 2007 Teacher of the Year for my work teaching Japanese in the West Metro High Schools. But for the past 5 years now, I've been working as an innovation facilitator and a personalized learning facilitator with District 287 in the West Metro area. Okay. And for those of you that aren't familiar with District 287, we have 12 member districts. We're an intermediate school district. And we like to say that we do the things that school districts find hard to do on their own. And about 4 years ago, we had a strategic plan that came into place, and innovation was one of the arms of that strategic plan. And when we looked at that, we wanted to make it other than something that was just a poster on the wall where you walk by and you say, oh, yeah, innovation, we do that. So we looked at what had been done in business research for innovation, and then we tried to combine that with some educational research and move forward on a plan that would personalize learning for students. How can we flip learning? How can we blend learning? How can we really make the educational experience more personalized for our students through, in many ways, the use of technology? Well, we looked at some research by Tayek and Cuban that basically was a wide span look at educational reform over the past 100 years. And their conclusion was that grassroots incremental change had led to vast systemic improvement. So we took that finding, and then we looked at what Google did with their engineers. And many of you may be familiar with this, where they carve off, for some of the engineers, they carve off 20% of their time, and they remove them for their core responsibilities, and they see what they do with that other 20%. And a lot of what they've discovered is that their innovations and their new ideas and their new products in the past decade have come from that 20% time. So we took a look at those two concepts, and we said, how could we apply these to education? And what we came up with was an innovation coach model. We said, what if we took some of our creative, out-of-the-box thinkers, teachers who really kind of bend the rules in a good way, and we gave them 10 to 20% of their time to work at their sites with their staff on individualizing or personalizing learning. And we gave them two specific mandates. One was increased student achievement, and the second was increased staff efficiency. And then we sat back and we saw what they could do. Now, we hold them. It's a project-based initiative, and there's high accountability in it. But I'm happy to say this is the fourth year of the project right now. In each of the past 3 years, this team of innovation coaches has produced over 100 projects in each of the past 3 years. Some of the projects, and there's a wide variety. As you hear, our topics today span a wide spectrum of educational needs and concerns, and so is their projects. In our supplemental online course, we found research that basically said if there's an orientation in a course, students will achieve at higher rates. So we built an orientation course for our supplemental program, and our attrition rates have declined. One of our other innovation coaches, Scott Swanson, who has an expert with Google Docs, looked at how we looked at case studies for students and was able, by using collaborative measures with Google Docs, work together with teachers so that now that group of teachers can cover three students in an hour meeting rather than just one student. So he's tripled the efficiency of the teachers in that group. Another of our innovation coaches in a completely different line is Jason Backus. He was noticing that students were coming home hungry at the end of the weekend. And when he started to ask them what was going on, he discovered they didn't have any food in their house. So he was able to connect with local charities. Now we have 50 to 70 of our students at North Education Center that go home with backpacks full of food. A couple of the other ones that I'd like to share with you a little bit today is we have some special education teachers, one of whom was an innovation coach, Diane Garrett Smith. And she looked at how our special education students were using their iPad apps. And what she found was that special education students were struggling a lot with how these apps were used. The off-the-counter, the over-the-counter apps just weren't really appropriate for their needs. So she asked a simple question. She said, what if we made our own apps? And so we kind of followed that line of thought a little bit, and we connected with some app developers. And we've now built two apps, one called Click and Talk, one called Talkin' Photos, that are photo manipulation apps that work perfectly with that audience. They're on sale on iTunes. They've been downloaded over 20,000 times over the past 2 years. And we're currently building our third app now, which is a behavior management and behavior tracking app for special education students. A last project that we're working on now is called the Minnesota Collaborative Curriculum Project, which I'm particularly excited about. It came about, as so often innovation does, through a problem where basically the Minnesota Studies curriculum had shifted to sixth grade over the past couple years, and there was no curriculum to teach it. So some of our member districts said, well, what are we going to do? We said, well, what if we took some of our creative teachers, our Minnesota Studies teachers, and asked them to build a digital curriculum that could be used in a traditional environment, could be used in a flipped environment, could be used in a blended environment, and made it with open educational resources, build it to the Common Core, and could be distributed freely when it's done. And so it's currently being piloted by these six teachers. The response from students and teachers has been fantastic. We're really excited about the results. And the project is now going to scale. So we have 30 school districts on board. And the goal of the project is to build one-year curriculum for every grade from 3 through 12 in four major areas: science, math, social studies, and language arts. So this project is going ahead at full speed. And so that's kind of a summary a little bit of what we do. And I've been particularly excited and wanted to share some of that work. I don't necessarily have a particular agenda other than to say that I think given the opportunity, we have some tremendous talent in our public education teachers and can really affect some systemic change with the right systemic structures in place.
Thank you, Mr. Smart. And for our first round here, the concluding presentation will be given by Ryan Vernosh. He's with the St. Paul Public Schools, and I'll happily disclose he lives in my district in White Bear Lake. Welcome.
Thank you. I'd like to take the opportunity to thank you all for listening so intently to our stories here, and also thank you for your leadership in Minnesota in the field of education. Without bold leadership, we are not able to do what we can do in our classrooms. My name is Ryan Vernosh. I am currently a policy and strategic planning and intergovernmental affairs administrator in St. Paul Public Schools. Prior to that, I spent most of my career working as a sixth grade boy single gender classroom in the St. Paul Public Schools, and also have taught preschool, which was probably one of the most fulfilling and rewarding teaching positions that I've experienced. Last year, I had the distinct honor of working for Secretary Duncan in the United States Department of Education, traveling the country, learning about what other states and districts are doing to help eliminate the opportunity and achievement gaps that really plague not only Minnesota but the entire country. And throughout those travels, people have looked to Minnesota for answers. There are Minnesota has a tremendous reputation for doing things well and doing and honoring students, families, and and teachers. And so again, that's a testament to the leadership that you all help provide. Now, as a teacher, I work with my former students in the fierce urgency of now, that we know that what happens today in our classrooms have ripple effects for generations. And so a lot of the testimony that was given today by my colleagues refer to that urgency of now and make a more professional, moral, and ethical case for eliminating the opportunity and achievement gaps that we have for our students living in poverty and the racialized gaps that we have. Another case can be made also about the economic implications if these gaps are sustained. There's an incredible sense of urgency for collective action to eliminate these gaps. By 2020, 74% of jobs will require post-secondary education. Now, that's reality. So we have to take a look at who have had access to post-secondary opportunities. Unfortunately, our families and students of color are the ones who have not had these access to these institutions. And the fastest growing population in Minnesota are going to be people of color, people that have been historically marginalized in our education system and society at large. And a side effect of the systemic marginalization has been that these fastest growing populations have traditionally been the least prepared for and least likely to participate in post-secondary education. Just a few statistics. For those in Minnesota that are 25 and older, only 26% of people of color have, or 26% of people of color have less than a high school education. That's compared to just 4% for whites. When looking at college readiness, 21% of African American students are college ready as defined by an ACT study. That is 65% for whites. To continue with these trends are going to have a devastating impact on the future economy of Minnesota. Now, how do we reverse these trends? We need to develop a comprehensive birth through 21 educational framework. We need to get past the paradigm of separate silos of K-12, early childhood, higher ed. We are all in this together, and it's going to take cooperation. The work being led by Commissioners Casilius and Pogemiller and Chancellor Rosenstone have the potential to be transformational in how we move this work forward. We need to look at how we create increased opportunities for college coursework in high schools. Even looking at what's the potential for attaching an associate's degree to a high school diploma. And this work also begins with the stories that each one of us have talked about today. It begins with Leanne and her stories about Mythbusters and how we create the mindset required in our teachers to believe in the capacities of the young people we're privileged to serve to become those Mythbusters. It continues with early childhood family education and parent education. We need to be destructors of that poverty of hope. Once we've lost the audacity of that hope, then the work that we have to do collectively makes it all that much more difficult. It begins with what Derek talked about in teacher evaluation, how we help raise achievement through improved teacher quality and evaluation that's linked to differentiated professional development. We have to get past the model of a one-size-fits-all professional development. And that can also help with your leadership to work with the United States Department of Education to ask for increased flexibility on Title II dollars and Perkins dollars for career and technical education. It also begins with the work that Jackie described about the Common Core and refusing to allow that zip code should determine one's success in school and beyond. And also with what Mike talked about with the personalized learning and how we create the space for our teachers who are incredible innovators to have that time and space to develop personalized learning plans for each of their students so we can identify what specific needs are and what we can do to push our students who may be in 10th grade but can already meet graduation standards to be able to offer them increased college access while still in high school. Now, we cannot do any one of these things in isolation and expect results. We have had a system built on inequity for generations, and I would argue since the inception of this country. And we'll take a systems-wide approach in order to have more than isolated pockets of excellence in our schools. We cannot nor will not ever legislate our students to success. We can, however, create a policy environment that allow our teachers the time and training to flourish. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Vernosh, and to each of the testifiers. We have, I'm sure, several questions. We've had proposals by many of you at the table addressing these subjects. Now, you know, here are experts, and you know, they aren't lobbyists. You know, being paid, you know, they are, not to be pejorative on that subject, but you know, they're here out of the love, the passion for students, and want to do what's best, which is what we want. And I'd like to just open it up at this point. And you know, if anyone would like to, and we'll start with Senator Nelson. And again, if everyone make sure to speak right into the mic as we're being televised.
Thank you, Chair Wieger, and to our testifiers today. It was a very rounded presentation, and as Senator Wieger mentioned, we've been working on a number of these fronts. A couple things that resonate particularly, I appreciated the emphasis on early childhood and how important that is. As a former Title I teacher and a reading specialist, I can see firsthand the gaps that children enter school with when it comes to a listening vocabulary, which is the building block for obviously reading vocabulary. And so one thing I'd just like to mention to this joint committee, because it didn't come through this committee, but I believe it's of great importance to this committee, and that is the initiative last year that we had regarding the child care subsidies. We have about $400 million that we spend on child care subsidies in our state, and yet there's really no tie to quality there at all. And legislation that Senator Torres Ray and I put forward last year actually would take a step towards putting some quality so that, you know, these are the very kids that we're talking about here. We're talking about closing the achievement gap, which is essential for the economic stability of our state. And yet, and we talked about the racial gap, but actually the economic gap, the economic gap between disadvantaged students economically and others is twice that of the racial achievement gap. And so it's just unconscionable that we would not use our dollars most effectively with those disadvantaged kids from disadvantaged, economically disadvantaged homes by making sure that they're their early childhood experiences of some quality. So I'm hoping that that's something we can go forward with in the next session. We did pass it out of – it's because our early childhood dollars are in the Health and Human Services budget, didn't come through our education committees here. Did pass out of HHH last year, and we did pass it off the Senate floor, but that provision was lost in conference committee. So I'm hoping we can continue forward with that to make sure that our children are that we're maximizing those public dollars when it comes to early childhood and the effectiveness thereof. And another piece that we will continue on is the digital learning bill that was actually passed in the 2012 session. And it's time for us to review that. Certainly there are pieces of that that are so important. One has to do with that online catalog. We've requested that the Online Learning Consortium, in conjunction with the Minnesota Department of Ed, make an online catalog of all of those online resources that are that align with Minnesota grad standards. We don't want great people needing to reinvent the wheel. We want you to be able to check those catalogs, see if there's already some resources that are aligned to our standards. Maybe we need some new resources, but that's an advantage for our teachers. But we haven't, Madam Chair, we've not seen back that, and I'm talking to Chair Torres Ray here, we haven't seen yet the response on that online digital learning catalog. They've reached the timeline now where they're supposed to report back to us. I hope we'll do that right away in February, get the where are we on that progress. And the other piece in that bill that is I think will be of great interest to Mr. Smart, particularly, is that we've asked to have a review of our statutes currently in place and how they affect digital learning, allowing students to learn in their own pace, their own place, their own path. And we've not seen that report yet. We need to request that we get that review of our current statutes and laws, and is it impeding? Which ones are impeding digital learning? How do they need to be changed? And so those are a couple things that I hope we'll move forward with in February. Again, I mean, I think we have all the resources here. You know, teachers are the number one in-school variable. Let's make sure we have our best teachers in front of our kids. We know parents are the first and most influential teachers. Let's make sure that we're working with our parents to make sure that our kids are entering school ready to learn, and then I think we have a chance to close this achievement gap. But I think we need to align all those resources, and I think we're moving in that direction, and hopefully we can continue starting in February when we reconvene to move forward some of those initiatives.
Thank you. Sarah Nelson, I believe we're on the same page on the importance of early learning. And you point out there's a significant amount of funds, $400 million. And, you know, we talked about the $40 million that we put in for scholarships, but, you know, the need for additional coordination. And that is being looked at right now. The department has in education, there's, you know, the agency's working on this, but we want to get the best yield for a dollar, and you know that, and you know, have made that plea. And but we have a statute that says ready for K, and but you know, we need to make sure with limited dollars we're investing that money the most effective way. You know, so if any of the testifiers would like to amplify further on that, as well as on digital learning, we hadn't touched on that before we go to another question. On the need for interagency cooperation, which, you know, we would stipulate is important, but maybe you could add some additional things. And also, you know, we're looking at, you know, measuring, you know, when, are you ready for K? And you know, ultimately, you need some measurements, and you might want to comment on that as well, because when we're looking at dollars to see return on investment, there needs to be some way to evaluate.
I agree. I think some of the first dollars we saw came through Health and Human Services and Parent Aware dollars and Scholarship and Child Care Aware. One of the places that I'm aligning with folks in my corner of the state is to take a look at having parent educators be trained for the Minnesota Center for Professional Development, be part of their trainers, and submitting TARFs, so approved training, so that we can get out and do some of that training for child care providers all over the state. So the word isn't getting out as fast as it needs to be. And I understand that that's rolling out county by county. And so in our corner of the state, we're not required, but soon will be. Providers will be required to, if they want their training to apply to their parent aware status, that it has to be parent aware approved. And so that's an interesting concept to try to think about how to put education dollars in that, where there's resources in their public schools and resources in early childhood and in parent education that could really help move that parent aware along. So I'm excited about the possibilities and working well with the folks at Think Small. Thank you. Yep.
If I might comment on the two points.
And just for the tape, Mr. Smart, and each testifier, state your name when you're.
Sure. Mike Smart. To comment on the digital learning piece, I think for one aspect, as you mentioned, an online catalog, one thing to consider is that this environment is changing so fast. I was just down at the iNACOL conference, which is a national conference about online learning. And I was talking to the head of the organization who said last year they had maybe a half a dozen presentations that were on the topic of blended learning. And this year they had 75% of their presentations were on blended or flipped learning. So this environment, which was traditionally online or traditional delivery, has turned on a dime. And the next thing that we'll see in the next 2 to 3 years will be initiatives along the flipped and blended lines. So it's much grayer than it was 2 or 3 years ago. And personally, I think the blended and the flipped opportunities offer tremendous potential because they're much closer to what the majority of us as educators are used to, and they really allow a much stronger impact for teachers. The second piece, I think it mentions the review of statutes, and that is, if there were anything I would ask the committee to ask as you go forward, is to consider legislation, because we see that does happen. There's often very well-intended legislation that has elements of it that prohibit us because of either seat time requirements that unintentionally stifle innovation in education, and to be mindful of that as you craft legislation.
Just to follow up.
Sarah Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for those comments. That is so critical, and I appreciate that support. And just to know, our Minnesota digital learning law does include flipped learning and blended learning. So we're moving in the right direction, but I so appreciated your testimony.
Yes, if we go in order, Mr. Vernosh, did you have a question or a comment? And then Mr. Olson.
Quick comment, if I will. Ryan Vernosh.
When looking at digital access, I think this also is inherently an equity issue on who has access to the broadband, who has access to actual devices, not only within school but outside of school settings. In my travels around Minnesota, especially in greater Minnesota, broadband can be an extraordinary challenge. And so I'm not sure what is all in the specifics of the law that you're talking about, but we need to look creatively on how we increase access for students who traditionally have not had access, and that could be include working with subsidies with communities, with cities, to have citywide access and things of that nature. But that equity piece, I believe, needs to be addressed in everything we do in this and all areas.
Derek Olson, I agree with what Ryan was just saying, and I think that it is exciting, though, at the same time, that Minnesota really is a leader in the digital and flipped learning. In fact, the National Flipped Learning Conference was held in Stillwater this past summer, and Stillwater was chosen because of all the exciting things happening here in this state. So I think we have a lot to be proud of as far as our leadership and what's happening with things like what Mike is doing, but we need to be really mindful at the same time of making sure those opportunities are available for everybody.
Thank you. We're also joined by Senator Leroy Stump, the chair of the Capital Investment Committee. That's where most of the money will be this session, upcoming session. And he's previous chair of the Finance Committee as well for education. Senator Stump, would you like to introduce yourself, your district?
Sure. thank you, Mr. Chairman. I represent Senate District 1, which is the far northwest corner of the state. I have six counties up there that I represent, and it borders Manitoba and North Dakota. And there's a lot of manufacturing up there, but a lot of agriculture as well. And we have Minsku has a campus in East Grand Forks, Thief River Falls, University of Minnesota has a campus in Crookston, and then as you go out, you have Bemidji is about 100 miles from us, and Moorhead's about 130 miles.
Thank you. We have a few questions. We're going to try to take them in order presented. It might even be easier just to go around the room, judging on the hands that are going up. But I believe next is Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And first of all, thank you to you and to Senator Torres Ray for putting this together. It was wonderful to hear the things that you talk about that are so important to all of us. I have questions for everybody. And for Leanne, you talked about the teacher being the very most valuable person in the school and impacting on what happens to a child. And I agree with you totally. I think it was you who said it. Maybe it was one of the others. But so what I'm wondering about, why is it that the students of color fall back in the achievement gap when they're taught by the same teachers as the people, the white people?
Leanne Stevens, that is a great question. That is a really good question. And so often our students don't see themselves represented in our teaching staff. And so I'm the only black female teacher in my building. And so what does that say to a black student or a brown student, when we tell them that you can be anything you want to be, you can achieve, but yet standing in front of them, no, they don't see anyone who reflects them at all. I am really convinced that this we have to change our belief systems. We have to change what we believe about black and brown students. And often we speak a certain game, but it doesn't follow with our actions. And students, and they know it. And a lot of times there is a soft bigotry of low expectations. And I think that comes into play, and we don't want to admit it. But I see it every day, and my students see it every day.
And Mr. Chair, and Ms. Stevens, so what can we do to get the dominant white teachers to look at the black students or colored persons of color, to look at them as having great potential. And let me tell you, I was in the Minnesota House from 1986 to 2000, and education was always an issue with me. And this brings to mind my visit to it was Central High School here in St. Paul. And I was asked to go and visit that school because of the high number of persons of color in that education, in that school. And I told the person who was taking me there that I didn't want to have a tour with the superintendent or the principal, or I didn't want to have a student who was in the high-level classes telling me about the school, but rather I wanted to walk into any classroom that I chose to without being announced. And I did that. And then later on I talked and saw some very strange things. And then I talked to a young woman, and she was a black student, and I asked her, why aren't you in one of the IB programs or whatever it was that they had there? And she said, well, my counselor told me that he didn't think that I would fit into that program. I saw her as a person with wonderful potential. So there's an example of and this person was a white person. And I saw when I went into the IB classes, it was almost all white kids. And when I went into the local history class, and I'll tell you, this was so disappointing to me. I walked into that classroom, and it was, you know, regular, more like half and half, because there were a lot of black students at Central at that time, and I presume there still are. The teacher was sitting on the desk, and when I came in, he didn't know who I was, and he said, you know, Joey, if you don't start shaping up, you're never going to get out of this room or this school. I just kind of went, wow. It's no wonder there are issues. So, I mean, that is what you're talking about and what I'm talking about. We have to deal with, and I share the view that one of you presented, that, you know, without looking at all of those people of color, our economy in this state for people who want money and to make money and to pay taxes to have a state that's worthwhile living in, we need to make sure that all of those children and basically get enough food and then get treated like they have great potential. So if you can help us out with that, it would be great.
Leanne Stevens, you have all the answers. No, I'm just kidding. Leanne Stevens, yeah, talking. You know, I'm really glad. I think, first of all, we have to have an honest conversation. So we have to have a courageous conversation, admitting that we do have biases and prejudices. And I appreciate that you bring that up, because we feel so uncomfortable when we talk about race. But it's out there, and our students are talking about it every single day. And believe me, they're talking about it with me every single day. And so I feel like once we get on the other side of fear, because that's what happens, like we fear the unknown. And so once we get on that other side, we will see such success. I tell my black and brown students every day, you are the standard bearers of excellence. The dominant culture, they don't set the standard for you. You set the standard. And I was speaking with a teacher yesterday, an English teacher at my school, honors English, who I gave a hug and just wanted to give her, you know, as my students would say, I wanted to give her some props, because she really pushes these black students and browns. She pushes them, but she gives them the support as well to be successful. And that's the key. Like, she's tough on them, but boy, does she give them the support, and they know that you care. And it begins with relationships. That is so important. If I really value you and I really want you to be successful, I am going to know who you are. I'm going to find out your story, because everybody has a story, and your story is going to be important to me. But then if I really believe that you can learn, and you will learn, then I'm going to do everything within my power as a teacher to have you learn. I believe, figuratively speaking, if I have to stand on my head to get you to learn, and if I haven't stood on my head, then I haven't done everything in my power to help you be successful. But you got to believe it. Those students know I believe that they are excellent. And I tell them all the time, you go out there and you show and you be excellent. Because I'm bringing everything excellent to you, and I want you to go out there and be excellent as well. And if we don't change how we think as teachers, and also change how they believe, what they believe about themselves, that they are worthy of our giving them the best that we can possibly give them. So,
Senator Hall, and on deck, Senators Franson, Clausen, and Kent, possibly others. Senator Hall.
Okay, thank you. I've got a couple things here, and just a follow-up to what was just discussed. Does our constant discussion, I wrote this down so I'd have it somewhat correct, and distinction of the blacks and minorities having a larger achievement gap and lower graduation add to the problem of a lack add to the problem of a lack of a positive encouragement and improvement? In other words, no matter how well-meaning we might be, sometimes we talk about the minorities and the blacks as different, and I think that promotes the problem because all men are created equal. I personally don't like hearing about the differences, because I think we should concentrate on the similarities and how to encourage, as you are, the positiveness that we expect the best out of every student, no matter where they come from, no matter what color they are. And that's the way I try to live my life. So that's number one. I'll just make that statement if I could. My other discussion, and if I have time later today, I have another one, but if you could give me one improvement, and I've heard some, not only here, I've heard other places, to improve or eliminate the achievement gap, not going into a long discussion, and maybe some of you have already said, I've given that, okay, but the one thing, just give a phrase I've heard in the past, if we improve reading before third grade, if we have more money, we would take care of the achievement gap. If we would have less union control, we would have eliminate the achievement gap. If we just have the Common Core, what would be that one thing that you would say as the best of the best, that if we could do one thing, and I'd be glad if some of you said the same thing, or all of you said the same thing, if we could start.
Okay, we're looking for a silver bullet, or?
There you go.
Okay.
Thanks, Chuck.
Which there is not, but okay.
Ryan Vernash speaking. Thank you, Senator Hall, for the questions and comments. And I, too, agree that with the first part of your comments that all men are and women are created equal. However, that has not, in my experiences and studies and lived experiences, been how we are created equal but not treated equal. There have been incredible differences that I have seen in legal systems and healthcare access, in housing discriminatory practices, in a whole litany of things which continues a marginalization of people of color. And all those have impacts on what my students are doing in the classroom and what they're bringing in. And oftentimes our students of color, and I've heard this conversation after conversation after conversation around Minnesota and across the country with our students of color, that say we're not being heard, we're not being looked at, our experiences, our lived experiences aren't being honored and valued. Being a white middle class educator person, my teaching experiences at the school I taught at, sixth grade boys in St. Paul, was 99% students of color, 99% students living in poverty. And we had great success with our students because there was a belief structure and because I feel we created a outlet, a venue for our students who have different lived experiences than what I had growing up, an opportunity to talk about those, an opportunity to weave those into the daily happenings of our community. And too often in our society, I think, especially for our kids of color, there are expectations perpetuated through media, through movies, literature, music, that try to define people and what paths are available to them. In the class that I taught, we always talked about I am somebody, where we need to deconstruct what those myths are and what the society is perpetuating on you to say, I'm not going to let anybody define my own lot in life. That's up to me. But we still have to honor and value the differences in lived experiences that I've had personally and my students have had. And with regarding the one thing to close the achievement gap, and I would also offer we need to change our language about the achievement gap. The achievement gap does put the onus on individual students, I believe. It puts the onus on the quote-unquote other outside of looking at ourselves. We need to come up with a conversation, a language of an opportunity gap, of an educational deficit that we've had for our students, that there are certain students have been denied opportunity and access, and that's not their fault. That's our system's fault that we need to look at and address. There is no one silver bullet. I think literacy, early literacy, will help tremendously. I think parent involvement, parent engagement will help tremendously. But I think it really comes down to how we're preparing and developing our teachers, how we're having our teachers look internally at what their lived experiences are, and how to create the authentic curiosity to learn about the lived experiences of the students we're privileged to serve and incorporate that into our daily curriculum. Thank
you. Other testifiers? Yes.
Jackie Rail. I would like to talk more about what Ryan said with the opportunity gap. So for my 15 years at Edina High School, we have worked on the racial achievement gap and trying various programs. We also had a gender gap in our English curriculum where our enriched classes were 75% female, 20 to 25% male. They were 99% white or Asian, and rarely, maybe once every 5 years, a black or brown student would walk into an enriched English classroom. And so we tried various programs. We even went to an all-boys English class to try to, what can we do to raise the opportunities and raise the achievement of all students? And after studying for 6 years, we came to the conclusion that the only way we could do that is to give every student the highest curriculum we could give. And so we are in our second year, and we are one of the only schools around in the metro area that we have all of our students taking our enriched English class. So all of our sophomores are in one class, taking the highest class, and the kids rise to the occasion. When you have the belief in them and you have a differentiation happening all the time in the classroom, their identity has made a complete switch. And we did it to close both the racial and gender gaps in our 10th grade. And the racial gap is so embedded in prejudice and stereotypes that people have of the students walking in that it's going to be harder to eliminate. But in our very first year, we switched our gender gap in our reading scores. For a decade, the girls had outperformed boys on reading. We knew we had a gender gap, and everyone had the expectation that boys don't read, so it doesn't matter. Boys don't care to read. And in our very first year on the MCA, the boys outperformed the girls by 3 points, on the 3 percentage points in 1 year, just by telling boys that they had that we have expectations that they will read. So we're hoping that given some longevity, given some switch in racial consciousness of students and teachers in our school, that we can have that effect on the racial achievement gap too. So thank you.
Leanne Stevens. Senator Hall, I appreciate your honesty. I appreciate your perspective. And so you have to appreciate that I will beg to differ with you. When you first see me, the first thing you notice is my outward appearance. I'm a black woman, and I want you to acknowledge that I am, because that's who I am. And to say that, you know, you don't want to talk about like black, why can we all just kind of move with our similarities? But we do have different experiences. You and I have different experiences. I have to live in two worlds. My black and brown students have to live in two worlds. I have to teach them how to live in two worlds. I teach them how to code switch. And so that's what we're dealing with. And when I go to Target, I'm followed. I'm working on my doctorate. That doesn't matter. They see my black skin, and they follow me in Target. I get followed in Macy's. And so, It's with me all the time. It's with my students all the time. And so we look through, I look through a racial lens where maybe you don't have to do that because that's your world. But I have to get into your world every single day. And we have different experiences. Our students have different experiences. I have students every day who are fighting to be heard, literally fighting to have their voice heard in their advanced placement classes, because those were classes that were traditionally white and they were excluded. And so they're in those classrooms, and the stories that I have, you would not believe. I literally have students who are working in groups, and they're the only black student in that group, and their work is, first of all, their voice isn't heard. When they have to put their information on Google Docs, either once they've put it on there, someone has gone in and changed it, or before they've had a chance to put it on there, someone has gone in and done the work for them. And so then I have to say, what do you do? What is your responsibility? What is your role? Well, Mrs. Stevens, I'm going to go and tell them that I have the work done. I will do it. Or I'm going to go in and delete what they put in for my part and put mine in. And so the only barrier is this. This is the barrier, because they look at this and they automatically assume that these students aren't as intelligent, and they are. They're so bright, but they're navigating an environment. So it's not just the academic piece of it. I have to navigate the system, and I get really passionate about it because people don't understand. My students have to navigate a system that has not been set up for them, and I have to give them those tools. And so they're in this environment that really doesn't think people don't think they belong there. So I have to deal with the academic piece, but I have to deal with your attitude about my worth. And so I'm proving that, and they're exhausted. They tell me they're tired. Like, I'm tired of having to go, look at me. I really do have a lot to offer. I really do know this AP psychology. It gets exhausting. But they have to prove themselves every day. I have to prove myself, still, as a black teacher, that I'm worthy of the title that I have, that I can actually teach, that I know what's going on. It's exhausting, but this is what we deal with every day.
What an answer. Yeah. Excuse me. Go ahead.
I'm Katie Smith. I will tell you the thing I probably will take home today that made my heart swell is looking at all of you when we introduced ourselves, and then when you introduced yourselves and thanked us for the work that we do. I think it's tough to be a teacher. I think it's tough to be a public school teacher. I think in Minnesota there was a time that everybody revered the work that we do, that everybody knew that we had the most precious resources in our schools, and they trusted us and believed in the work we were doing. That would go a long way to the achievement gap if every teacher felt as elevated as I did right here in this morning when you all looked at me and said, thank you very much for the work that you do. It's small, and I had to just think of one. I have about six, but that's the one I'll offer you today. That when you legislate with that child that I'm holding in your heart, when I'm teaching with that child I'm holding in my heart, when we all know that we're doing the great work in Minnesota that needs to be done and support one another in it, we go a long way for any of those gaps. In my heart of heart, I believe that, sir. Thank you.
Mr. Olson.
Derek Olson. I'd like to reiterate what Katie just said. I've in the research I'm doing for my doctoral study right now, I've come across some fascinating recent studies looking at the global achievement gap and how we are actually as well struggling compared to countries around the world. And there's been some studies looking at the countries at the top, specifically Finland and Korea, and what do they have in common that puts them right there at the top in science and reading right and math right now? Very little. Except for one key characteristic, the way education is respected in their culture. Their methods are very, very different, but there's an incredible respect for education and the profession of education. And I think that is something that as teachers of the year, we all view as a very important part of our job is to help elevate the teaching as a profession, both the way others view it and also, quite honestly, within our profession itself. And so that's one silver bullet, and a second silver bullet. If we had two shots, given that I was talking about teacher evaluation and teacher quality, we are at a crucial crossroads here in Minnesota where we are asking districts to radically think differently about how they look at their teachers,
And I think you all are in the position to make the decision of, can the resources be made available to do that well? Because it is definitely true that teacher quality impacts achievement. And to raise teacher quality requires good, individualized, differentiated evaluation of where teachers have weaknesses and then what to do to bring them forward with good development. And that does take resources, and those resources have to come from somewhere. Thank you.
Good. Mr. Smart?
Mike Smart. I would like to segue off of what Ryan said and what Derek implied with his two silver bullets. I don't think there is a panacea or a silver bullet for this. When we look at the achievement gap, we have to understand that, of course, it is a societal issue as much as it is an educational issue. And this isn't to shirk responsibility from an educational perspective. I think there's tremendous potential to affect change within the educational environment. But it is a broad societal issue that needs a number of perspectives on it. If I were to offer one thing, and it's something that I've thrown my life into for the past 4 years, is that idea of personalizing our learning experience. One story that I like to tell, if I could be brief about it, is that when I grew up, we had three TV channels, and one of my favorite shows in the holiday season was How the Grinch Stole Christmas. And that would come by, say, December 17th from 7 o'clock to 8 o'clock in the evening, or 7 to 7:30. And if you missed it, that was it. You just had to wait a year. And I think in many cases, when I look at how we're teaching our children, we're teaching like we're ABC in 1960. So we have kids that need fractions, and if they don't get the fractions in those first 2 weeks of October, they don't get them for another year. And the same thing, when we can start toying with the idea of how do we work these opportunities to give kids chances to work at their own pace, to flip our instruction, as Stillwater has been such a leading example of, to blend our instruction. We've got great examples in Byron, Minnesota, of math teachers flipping their instruction. When we start to look at the potential for that, we see that we can really start to charge some of our students. Kids that need more time to get a concept can get it. Kids that can work faster can go forward. So I think there's tremendous potential looking at it from that angle.
Members, we're going to entertain four more questions and then ask the testifiers to give a one-minute summary that'll take us to 11:45 or so, and to honor some commitments I know that you have early afternoon. And Senator Wicklund, you're on our list too. I apologize for not having you there earlier, and we'll go to you next.
I just wondered if you could speak a little bit. I think another really important area is engaging families. And how can we do a better job of engaging families? I think a lot of the opportunity gaps come from, you know, it's a whole family issue. It's not just students in the classroom. Could you talk a little bit about what you think some key things that school districts could be doing in terms of engaging families better? And how do we as policymakers kind of assess, you know, what encouragement we need to provide districts for including family engagement and, you know, how to do it well? I think there's a lot of specific information about, you know, ideas people have, but how do we make sure that school districts are doing it well?
Ms. Smith, your body language is shouting.
I think a lot. I'm Katie Smith. I think a lot about this work, and like the Grinch told Christmas, I think we offer just the same old thing to invite families into school. Mm-hmm. Come for PTA breakfast, come for conferences. And what I think changes a school's culture about engagement is when you look at yourself as a resource for families. They're going to look for information about parenting. First of all, the parent-child relationship, how kids learn, how our kids in relationship with other kids, how do I keep my child safe, are all things that we know at schools that we could if we thought about the way we work differently. So we don't just teach one child, you teach a family, to share that information with schools. I would love it if you walked into a school and there was a parent classroom and a resource center right there, and there was somebody available right at transition times to visit with parents as they're coming or going, and with a series of classes that you could take, not every one of them, but homework and hormones is one that I think would fill an auditorium when you have a seventh grader. In ninth grade, how do I know if my child is safe, or if my child's involved in any risk activities? So parents sometimes come to us with, here's what I need. It's all fine and good how they're doing on a reading score, but is there any information for me to navigate it? It gets really tough in Minnesota to start talking about when your kids are not doing well. In fact, we don't support each other very well. We support each other beautifully when our kids are well. But we struggle as Minnesotans to say, how's your boy? he doesn't talk to me anymore, and I miss him. Or tell me about how he is, because I, you know, what's going on? We don't do that very well. Schools do that well. And so I would love to see schools just take that on. Like, why? How will we bring families in and not give them information we want to give them, but information that they really want for, from us and actually ask for from us?
Leanne Stevens. Parent engagement is always a hot topic, but I think we also need to redefine what that looks like. A lot of times we come from this middle class view, and I'll say a white middle class view of what parent engagement looks like. And we always, we're like, well, we offered this and they didn't come. We had parent-teacher conferences and our black parents didn't show up or our Latino parents didn't show up. You know what? We need to go to them. We know where they live. We know where the community centers are. We know we can go to them. And so we have to change this. And because I don't come to a parent-teacher conference does not mean I'm not engaged with my child, because I'm getting my child to school every single day. And so to me, that parent is engaged, getting their child there to school every single day. I had parents who couldn't come to me for a conference. So I said, you know what? I'll come to you. Or do you want to do it over the phone? Or offer other types of opportunities for these parents. And then if the first thing, whenever I hear from you from the school, it's because my child has done something wrong, why would I want to come to school and have a conversation? Because guess what? I get to hear more of what my son or my daughter has done wrong from you. I would call literally, and people can't, I don't know, people can say what they want. I've had a variety of teaching experience. I taught first grade, I taught sixth grade, fifth grade. I used to teach in Minneapolis. I taught gifted and talented. I was part of a startup charter school. I taught 100% white student population, 100% black. I mean, I've done it all. And when I had five classes, 125 students, literally, I called every single parent at the beginning of the school year, and I said how excited I was to have that child in my class. And so did that build some trust? Absolutely, because if I had to call then later because of some issues, I loaded it on the front end. And so that's, I think we have to really rethink what parent engagement, because our parents, our families, all look different. They've changed. It's not like it used to be. And so we don't have always one person staying at home all the time. I couldn't make it to parent-teacher conferences because they were at the same time that I was doing parent-teacher conferences. So if somebody didn't know I was a teacher, they'd think I was a totally disengaged parent. And I wasn't. And so that, to me, that's where it really starts.
Thank you. Senator Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you again for all of your insight. It's really remarkable to hear from you and just your passion, because you wouldn't be doing this if you didn't have the passion that we can hear in each and every one of your answers. So thank you. And just it reminded me, Mrs. Smith, about just Monday we were celebrating Veterans Day, and I had the honor to go to a luncheon in my district, and I was overwhelmed of just that simple words of gratitude and thank you. And we sometimes wait for Teachers of the Year or Veterans Day to say that, but you are fighting our own battles here in your classrooms every day, and we have to thank you each and every day for the service that you do to our community to teach our future leaders. So I just wanted to say that, and I also want to echo what Senator Nelson was saying earlier about parent aware, and we did, I serve on the Health and Human Services Committee, and we did want to make sure that we have that quality component in the funds that we're awarding in those programs, but there are still some challenges as well that I've heard in some of the providers that are having some challenges with getting access to the scholarship. So we'll have to tweak that. We'll have to fix that. And just like healthcare, there's, you know, nothing is perfect. We have the best intent, but sometimes we have to go back and try to make sure that these programs are actually intended and doing what we intend them to do. So we'll work more on that next year in next session to making sure that this program works for the intended purposes. What I did want to ask, next session in 2014, it's been characterized as the unsession. So, and I know there's no silver bullet in terms of what one thing we can do to fix this, because we wouldn't have jobs if that was the case, or we wouldn't be here today. But
there are things, and Senator Alice Johnson and I were just chatting of the first thing that came to mind, I'm going to share this, was food.
Thank you.
Is that something that would make a – I mean, I think it is, but we tried to do that last session as well, to remove the barrier of having free and reduced lunch and not having just making sure that all of our kids are ready to learn by making sure that they're healthy and their tummies are filled and they are able to learn. Because if you have the distraction of an empty stomach, I can't concentrate. I don't know about a five-year-old or a six-year-old. I can't concentrate as an adult, much less trying to learn. So that's an example, but I'm not sure if you have your particular interest. I'd be happy if everybody, again, probably agrees on what one thing you can get off the books that's not working, that was well-intended, but it just is a barrier, a burden to what we're trying to do, whether it's seat time. I mean, even if it's controversial, I think our committee would like to hear that and those ideas, because we are having serious considerations. Some of them might require some analysis, fiscal analysis, but I still think we should put those out there, especially coming from such a distinguished panel. So thank you, and if you can answer a couple of ideas, I'd really appreciate it.
Any of the testifiers suggestion? Mr. Vernash?
Yeah.
Thank you for the question. I think that is this?
This isn't our minute.
This isn't minute? Okay. I just processed. One of the areas that I've always really been interested in seeing how we can do it systemically is increased time for teachers to be able to study student work, to rather than having, if I'm a secondary teacher, an 8-hour day, rather than teaching 8 hours or seven periods, maybe six, and having an additional time period to study student work with colleagues. The teaching day is so packed with everything that sometimes just having that a little bit extra time to really dive into the student work, and I've seen it studies from various countries and different approaches that that's a very effective way to help teachers improve practice and personalize learning and grow achievement. I know there's huge financial implications of that, and it would be take a lot of political will to move anything like that forward, but I think that's one area that I think is worth considering.
Ms. Rowe? Ms. Rowe?
Oh, we're doing our 1 minute? Are we answering?
No.
Bullets. Jackie Rail, I wanted to answer Melissa's question on seat time. The Edina High School has implemented professional learning communities and built time into the school day to have teachers work together, because when you're dealing with trying to change the outcomes for student learning, you cannot have one student or one teacher in a classroom doing something that he or she did 20 years ago, especially if that student does have some biases that we've been talking about today. And so we have paired teachers together to work in a professional learning community, which has a lot of research behind that it will impact student achievement. However, we literally have to count our minutes now to make sure we have time for teachers to work together. And it's only 30 minutes a week we've carved out of our day, but we've, you know, had to, you know, shorten the time that students can pass in the hall and shorten the time in the morning. We are literally down to the minute, which is really constraining us a little bit.
Eric Olson, I would add to that. I think that one of the most precious commodities, resources that we need more of as educators is time. Did I take your line?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, so you didn't expect us to maybe all be in agreement, and maybe we have a little bit of agreement here. We'll need less bullets. But it is – and I think that we probably all feel that way in many aspects of our lives. If we had more time, you know, we could do a better job. And of course, time in a paid profession comes at a cost, but I think that I know many teachers that would trade for, you know, an extra half an hour of prep to prepare those lessons really good and to meet with colleagues. They would trade that over new textbooks any day.
Okay. Mike Smart, I have to learn to speak first in this group because now I have to think of something new to say, but I would agree with both what Derek and Ryan said, that professional development, time is our most precious commodity. I think we've seen that with the Innovation Coach project that we put in, is that we've freed up 10 to 20%. That's 4 to 8 hours, which isn't really much, but the incredible benefits we've seen from leveraging that time. The book that I threw in my car today that I'm bringing to a meeting later on for one of our Innovation Coaches is called 10-Minute In-Service, and I think the title of that book symbolizes how hard hard it is for us in face of all these demands to learn new things, to add technology to our classrooms, to personalize our instruction, to address the achievement gap. We're trying to fit all this stuff into the little cracks in our day. And if you can carve out time for us for professional development, I think that would be a huge difference.
And testifiers, there will be a chance to amplify a bit on any questions in your summation, but I'd like to get to a few remaining questions and ask members if they could limit their question or comment to 1 minute as well in asking.
Call me.
We will have a chance to get back on that. Next, Senator Claussen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, thank you for being here today. Your thoughts, your expertise is greatly appreciated. But I also wanted to say thank you for your commitment, for your leadership, for education in Minnesota, and for our students. Many of you, if you looked at your resumes, are getting advanced degrees. And I know that costs money, that costs time away from your family. And those are sacrifices that you're making, and it's greatly appreciated. Ms. Smith made the comment, the achievement gap begins at birth, and that is very true, and we have to start realizing it's an opportunity gap as well as an achievement gap. We've talked a little bit about systems-wide approach, and I serve on the Health Human Services Committee as well, and also Vice Chair of the Higher Ed, and we have to stop looking at things as individual silos. We have to start using our resources together to address this gap that we have. If you look at a lot of the issues or statistics across our nation, when you look at the fiscal disparity in our state between minorities and whites, when you look at employment rates, when you look at health care, when you look at incarceration rates, all those things point to achievement gaps. We've got lots of issues to address. And I think that we have to start blaming education a lot for these ills and start realizing it's an issue of opportunity that needs to be addressed, not just education. I'll take exception at one thing in that I always thought it was high school principals that really make the difference. Ms. Rail, you made the comment about Common Core. I think one of the problems in education, every 5 years the target switches. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden we're switching gears to something else, and we need to stay the course. I remember when the basic standards test came out, we looked at those standards and said 90% of our kids are college bound and these don't apply. We really need to look at ACT standards and make sure that we're aligning our curriculum so that our teachers or students have the skills and ability to be successful. So much of my, I guess, are more comments, really. I was on the board at the University of Minnesota College and the schools. I couldn't agree more with Mr. Vinash that we need to offer more opportunities for high school students to earn college credit, for those that are college ready. And also Moundsview District is having a program where students can earn an AA degree while still in high school. We need to expand those programs. Personalized learning plans connected with a career path, I think, is something we need to look at. Career education has gone by the wayside in our high schools. As soon as we started doing all the testing, we used to have career courses. We don't have career courses anymore. And I think we need to get back with connecting that career path to their education. So those are all comments. If you have any comments on my comments, I would appreciate it. But again, I greatly appreciate you being here today and the work that you do.
Thanks, Senator Claussen. Yes.
Leanne Stevens, I have a comment, and I agree with you so much about the career part piece. And I actually wrote a grant and got a grant to have the students with whom I work to have field experiences, five of them, where they're exploring careers that they might not have even thought about. And so they're so excited. We had our first one, which was at Cut Fruit Express, which we went and toured and had, you know, we talked about food security and so they didn't even realize, you know, the process of how fruit ends up in the stores and what they could, you know, the jobs that are available for that piece of it as well. And so that is really important for me, and especially for students who are like these first generation going to college or parents who really don't know the system, and so to be able to get them and to explore other careers is really exciting, and that's what I'm doing at St. Louis Park.
Mike Smart, I just offer one. I think it's important to consider, too, that the careers have changed since we looked at career. One of the things, that, as we look at a lot of our course offerings now, we see very little offerings in terms of high-level technology skills, like programming, website design, and things like that. And there, the world has changed around us, so what it means to be career-ready is quite a bit different, and to keep that in mind as we go forward with that.
And members, at our next meeting in December, we're going to be getting an update on the Career Pathway Task Force, which we asked for recommendations at the Department of Education. So make sure you're plugged into that as well, and we'll be reviewing those at the during the session, but get a preview of where they're at this point. Okay. Next, Senator Kent. And thank you, Senator Clausen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, just so many just effusive thanks and gratitude for you all for your dedication and your passion that is so apparent, and all our students are so lucky to have people like you on their side, so I just want to reiterate that. It comes through so loud and clear. We've covered a lot of the things that were sort of my agenda here for question, and so I'm going to just do a couple of comments, and if there's anything, there may almost be sort of like homework assignments in here for you guys and us as committees. One thing is this discussion about low expectations. Mr. Vernash, I attended a brown bag seminar a few weeks ago at Wilder with some folks from the St. Paul Public Schools, and some of the things that I know have been implemented there I think are really interesting, and it might be worth coming back and visiting. I know it seems like some things are being implemented already. I don't know how much there is in the way of results now, but it was fascinating in terms of challenging staff to really look at their own biases. We often don't see our own blind spots. That's the nature of them. And I was very impressed with some of the things that are being done in St. Paul, and I think it would be worth a longer conversation about that. And then the other thing, in terms of creating space for teachers and students, and going back to the unsession idea, and this is homework for our esteemed professionals, in addition to the pressures that we put on our teachers, we're also, I'm the parent of a seventh grader right now, so I was emailing teachers just this morning. We're putting pressure on the school year and the curriculum, and I look at math, and to the point about fractions, and they just have that narrow window to really master that, and if they miss it, they've missed it, and I've watched that, and it is challenging. Are there constructive ways that we can unpack some of the long, potentially teaching to the test, list that is being pressured in our kids' days and years? Not that we don't want to lower the standards, but are we going too far in one direction in terms of trying to do too many things too quickly and losing some of those core opportunities to really let these important messages sink in? So any constructive suggestions you have on that end, and I would even back that up. You were talking about how kindergarten has changed in a generation. Our younger students, have we pulled back too much physical time and recess time, you know, so that they don't get to let those little bodies release some of that energy and soak in some of what they're learning and making their day more effective in terms of learning? So I just throw those out there. I think we've hit a lot of themes that very much interconnect, and I really appreciate you all bringing that up. If there's anything anybody wants to share here. Otherwise, I think these are topics that we can keep looking at.
Initial feedback? If anyone like to react.
Katie Smith, we could have a whole conversation about rigor and what awesome. That looks like. Mm-hmm. I would love to. You call me. I will be here. I'll call these friends of mine, and we'll make that happen. That's a great, really big question that I think all of us would love to answer. We're a little squirmy in our seats because we've been invited to the governor's mansion for lunch.
At noon.
Yeah.
Cool. Okay. Senator Pratt.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be brief because so many of the questions have been asked, and quite honestly, there are so many more we could cover. I apologize for taking off. I had to meet a group of kindergarten students down in the rotunda, and that was a lot of fun. As I mentioned before, I served on the school board, and one of the topics that came up, Mr. Olson, you touched on that was of particular interest to mine was teacher evaluation. I've been managing people for over 15 years. I believe every employee deserves a review, an assessment of their work, their strengths and their weaknesses, a development plan, all things that I've worked on with the hundreds of employees that I've worked with. And we ask a lot of our principals. They have parents, students, food service, janitorial, professional folks, and it takes a lot of time. And I was always amazed that the best we could ask of them was three supervisions a year, which was, in my mind, wholly inadequate to draw a real conclusion around somebody's performance. You touched on a lot of things, and you know, the one thing in particular that struck me was, and I'll paraphrase, quality teacher is critical to a student's success. And so that's why this is such an important topic. You're among the best of your profession, and so what I'd like to know is, you talked about resources that needed to be available. Give me a sense of the type of resources, the focus of those resources. Where can we be effective? Where is it more? Where should we be allowing your local districts to be more effective?
Derek Olson, resources in regards to implementing the effective teacher evaluation plans?
Yeah. Okay. As you said, sure. We basically put an unfunded mandate right out there.
Correct. Okay, that's a great question, and I was hoping somebody would answer it, and I could go on for hours, and I have to counterbalance that with the fact that these guys want to go eat lunch. So, But I think that understanding that, if you think about it, it does seem like three evaluations seems, in essence, in a certain way, inadequate. But yet, when you think about, for instance, in my building, we have one principal. He has 80 employees, I believe, in the building total. And, you know, we're at 240 right there. And then that's just a small part of his job of overseeing the building. He's not just the administrator. He's, in essence, the manager of the building in so many ways. And you know, I've been asked many times in the last 23 years if I would consider an administrative path. And the answer is in no way. I have so much respect for principals, and I would never want to be one. And so that brings up an issue of time. Secondly, the research shows that if you give teachers, administrators enough training, their evaluations can be linked to student achievement, like that more highly evaluated teachers, students do better. But the problem is, without extensive amounts of training, their evaluations are all over the board when matched in a statistical test with student achievement. So to make the evaluations statistically relevant, if you're really going to make them high stakes as far as affecting teachers' pay and things like that, there needs to be a lot of resources into making those administrators really understand how and what they're evaluating. Now, that there's a lot less training that is needed to simply help them be able to point out, here are some things that if you worked on these things right now, it would really help you move forward fast. So in other words, the development necessary, would take less effort to make administrators able to help their teachers grow. Now, at the same time, from the teacher perspective, if you're going to take teachers and have them go through this process to be able to be reflective, to hear what their peers have to say about their teaching, to look at those surveys of what students have said, and to listen to what their administration, and then have the time to learn specifically what they need to learn to do better, and then after learning it, implement it in their classroom, all takes that number one thing we talked about, time, and it takes other resources as well. You know, they might need to go to a workshop, and that requires sub costs, and there's all these things. And then at the district level, those districts that are trying to do this collaboratively in a grassroots way that really fits the needs of their particular district, as opposed to using the state's default model, and it is entitled a default model because it's not the intention of the states that it would be better than what districts could come up with. That takes a lot of time. Our district, as I mentioned, is 50 meetings into developing our model, and that's just developing it and starting a pilot. Then we need to go full implementation next year. So there's so many different ways that resources are needed. And I don't know, I'm an expert in my classroom. I'm not an expert in finance and public education funding. So I don't know how you guys can make that magic work. But if you can, it would be great.
I know that you have an appointment with the governor. I know you've met with presidents as well. But that's very important to go to the governor. But if in 15 seconds or so, if each of you could give your key message again, and we'll start with Ms. Stevens.
Leanne Stevens, I would just like to say that I am so humbled and I'm so privileged to be a teacher. And if it weren't for the students, I wouldn't have a job. And so I honor them every single day. And I look at them and I say, what would I want for my own child? And so every decision that I make is based on what I would want for my own child. And that's what I would want to leave with you.
Katie Smith, I just want to thank you again for allowing us the opportunity to share our passion about what we do. Anytime that policy meets the practitioners, I think there's always a great discussion. And so for me to be here today and to give you a perspective from a practitioner has been very rewarding for me. Thank you very much for the work that you do. And know that you are more than welcome to contact us. I'm hoping that we have begun a relationship with you that you see as valuable, that you don't have to wonder about what it looks like in early childhood or what four stars in Parent Aware looks like. Now you have a face and a name and a bio from someone that can help you with that. So thank you very much.
I would like to just quickly thank you all for your service to our great state and for the intent listening, how you've listened to us so intently and valued what we have to say today. And if there are ways that we can be of service to you as you make decisions and want to tap a teacher on the shoulder and ask their perspective on something, please don't hesitate to contact us, because we do believe that that's part of our role as Teachers of the Year, is to be able to represent and support and move forward the education of the students in this great state. Thank you.
Jackie Rail, I actually had about 25 bullet points I didn't get to today, and I think that I'd like to extend an invitation to all of us to get together again sometime. I think that we really could have sat here all day and talked about education. There was so much more to say. And so if you ever want to have a panel, instead of just having one person testify, we can put together a panel for you of teachers at any time. So that's what I want to leave you with, that we'll be glad to come back whenever you want us to.
Mike Smart, I would also like to reiterate what everyone said. I think that the thing that struck me most about today is that there's a commonality of cause here. We're all in it for the kids, and I think I would also offer us up as in any way that we can be a resource to advance the cause.
And again, thank you again for your attentiveness, your time, and your thoughtful questions. And I'm changing trajectory in my career of looking more policy and bridging the often huge gap between policy and practice. And so I would love to continue this conversation amongst us and everyone forward. And I would also encourage all of us to look more holistically at the issues presented, that everything is interconnected, from a livable wage for everybody through increased healthcare access, through discriminatory housing, through a judicial system. Everything is connected, and it's going to take cooperation and collaboration. That we're currently in a paralyzed politic where we're constantly judging our successes at the feet of other people's failures. And we have to move past that and work together. And no one party has a monopoly on great ideas. We have to authentically listen to each other to move forward, because there is a commonality of our cause for our kids in Minnesota. Thank you.
Minnesota Teachers of the Year, on behalf of our joint committees, on behalf of the Senate, on behalf of the students that you so passionately serve, on behalf of the state of Minnesota, we so deeply respect you for your service, for your exemplary service, for spending time, that most valuable resource you can share, that time, and we look forward to our next conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And we will allow the members or the testifiers, we're going to just give you some concluding thank yous from Senator Sarita.
Please don't. You are welcome to go. I just have an announcement for the committee. Okay. I know you want to go. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. I just want to mention to the committee a couple of issues that are of importance, I believe. Members, as you know, this is a policy year, and we have about probably 21 meetings that we will have to have in the policy committee. I understand that you are already working on several ideas and projects that you want to move forward. I want to let you know that the House has about 10 times what we have. They will be moving a lot of legislation. I also want to make sure that you know that Representative Mariani and I have been meeting with multiple groups that will be coming to you to ask for legislation. So I want to make absolutely sure that you know that we have a very, very short session. You know this, but I want to remind you, when you make a commitment to author legislation for specific groups, individuals, constituents, I need to map out our time because I do want to give the time and the respect that you deserve in my committee. Any ideas, anything that you would like to do and work ahead of time so that we map out your constituencies, please, please let me know because we're going to have to work very diligently to connect with the House members so that you don't have things moving in the House that are different from your bill, and then we have to pair this up in the last, you know, 2 weeks and things kind of disappear and we don't know. I really don't want to deal with that. So I just want to invite you to connect with my office. Brad is here. Blanca is here. You are going to receive a letter from my office inviting you to call me anytime, any day, even weekends. If you would like me to go to your district or meet with people that you have a meeting, I would like to open that opportunity so that we start planning our hearings this week. So thank you for your attention and just wanted to let you know that this is going to be a very tough session for us. Yes, Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As a person whose life has been dictated by bells, I would suggest that we always make a point to start on time.
Absolutely. We are going to need to do that. We're going to need to really be very diligent, and you need to let us know ahead of time to put you on the agenda, have these discussions. A lot of things that we didn't finish last year that are going to be controversial, we're going to have to complete this year. So let's be prepared. Thank you,
Senator Torres-Ray, for having the joint meeting with our committee. And, again, our next meeting will be December 4th. It'll be a joint meeting. We're going to get updates on the various task forces. Some of you have been serving on these Department of Ed task forces. We'll also get some thoughts from you regarding proposals, if you'd like to share them for the upcoming session. And we're also going to ask our great staff to share the a review of what we did during the past session, a little update on things, and they're putting together some presentation information on that as well. So we'll have a lot, and we will start on time, and hopefully everyone will be here too. So, again, thanks. That was a great meeting, and happy Thanksgiving to all.
I was going to ask for the bells.
Thank you, Mr. I'm sorry.